Hey everyone, it is Bob Sagetts here for you, and it's the new year. Of course, it's 2021, the year that we thought everything was going to be perfect, and it eventually will be. Never perfect, but better. I am doing this in a different location. I am not in my study. I am in my office, so I'm at my desk, and so that's why this is different if you're watching it on the YouTube, and if not, you could care less. I don't, you know, you say on a first date, don't talk about religion, don't talk about politics. Well, I have a wonderful guest today who, you know, he talks about religion. He is a rabbi, Steve Leader. It's a good name. He is the leader of the Wilshire Boulevard Temple, one of the biggest synagogues in the world. He wrote a book that spoke to me. Because it's a talking book on tape. No, it spoke to me because I read it, and it's special. It's a special book, and I've got it right here. It's called The Beauty of What Remains. It's for everybody. It's about death. It's about embracing death. The byline is how our greatest fear becomes our greatest gift. And it's meaningful to me because I've lost so many people in my life, and I know many of you have. And you will, because it happens, and you all hope that people are extremely old when they lose someone they care about. But this is a universal book, and it's got wonderful people that give little talks on the back of it. Aaron Sorkin says, "With the beauty of what remains, Rabbi Leader has given us a profoundly thoughtful book that captures the same wisdom and wit that his congregation has experienced from him for over three decades. Give this book to a friend." And Maria Shriver said, "The wisdom Steve Leader shares in this moving book is an essential part of living a beautiful and meaningful life. Read it and feel inspired." And that's how I felt. He's a remarkable man. He has a soothing way of understanding and relating and compassion. And he's also the author of The Extraordinary Nature of Ordinary Things, More Money Than God, Living a Rich Life Without Losing Your Soul, and the bestseller, More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. But I would venture to say this book, The Beauty of What Remains, is one that's very compact. You can keep it in your backpack or shove it down your pants, as I do with all books, because I read my books down below. It's a special book. He's a special man. Before I bring him on, I just want to mention, do what you do with this. You subscribe and then you listen, or you can follow and listen, depending on where you get your podcast, or you can watch it on YouTube, you know, youtube.com/Bob Saget. And also, you can rate and review and all that stuff, comment, make it positive, because who wants to read any more pain right now? And the other thing I could say is that sometimes I call people and see how they're doing. There's a phone number up there. You could leave a message, and we check it out, my producers and I, and I'll be calling at a time where it feels the right time. But right now, it is an honor to bring it onto the podcast, Steve Leader.
Bob.
Oh, I love this. I love this. How are you?
I am great, but I just, it's interesting. We're going right to this podcast. I just finished an hour and a half, what I call intake for a funeral I'm doing for a family. 65-year-old guy dropped dead of a massive heart attack.
Is he okay?
Oh, he's dead.
No, I know. This is how I start my podcast.
I'm a straight man.
No, you're not. I have the book. I got the jokes.
The old snoring tuchus joke never failed.
A snoring tuchus is a fart, I believe.
Yeah, yeah, correct.
So I'm sorry. That's will probably be the last thing that I say when I pass this earth. Are you all right? How does this affect you? Because you spend a lot of time now, especially right with people grieving.
You know, I'll tell you. It is an emotional burden without a question. That being said, once I get into it and I start drilling down into the real questions and answers of a person's life, I will tell you this, everyone's life is amazing. Everyone's life is fascinating. Everyone has a story. And it's, if you really ask, if you ask the right questions, it's a beautiful journey with families through a person's legacy. It really is. So it's endlessly interesting to me.
Now, devil's advocating, there's a lot of people, as you know, and I'm on the team you're on, I believe in a gracious birth and a gracious passing. And those are the two most poignant moments, besides other many poignant moments. But what about the people that are suffering, that are going out painfully? How do you, well, look, how do you, I know you know how to address it because I read this book.
Well, I think the beautiful part of the intake with a family from someone who has suffered for a long time or terribly even for a short time is it allows everyone to journey back before the suffering began to re-embrace that person and to laugh again and to be on vacation again and, you know, to be walking down the aisle again and to be in the delivery room again and to journey back out of the present is such a beautiful thing for families, you know, and one of the gifts of memory, of course. There are some painful parts to memory as well. You know, in the book, I talk about the duality of memory and that's the truth about memory. We say, you know, oh, may his memory be a blessing and you'll have him in your memories. But I learned this from my father, from his journey through Alzheimer's and ultimately death, that there's a duality to memory. You know, memory is beautiful and it really hurts. It's both. It, you know, in the book, I say it's like being caressed and spat on at the same time.
That's true of a lot of what we're going through right now. I would look at the last year and where we're at this moment.
That's right. That's right. And it's always... You know, my mother used to make a great sweet and sour cabbage borscht.
Who didn't?
Yeah, and I've come to the conclusion that it is the most honest of all dishes when it comes to a metaphor for life. It's really both.
I eat all kinds of food from everywhere, and comfort food is comfort food.
That's, yes.
And that's fond memories for a lot of people.
Yeah.
That's why you look at the American population and so many people are overweight.
Yes.
Is because they need comfort. So you drink, you...
Yeah.
Are you finding people are drinking more or eating more?
I think that people are looking for home-based ways to escape. And that is clear. And by the way, for pleasure within reach, right? Because some of the things that we used to do for pleasure, go to a ball game, go on a trip.
Go
to a restaurant, have dinner with friends. So much of what we did for pleasure is literally life-threatening now. So I think it's also people really looking for that. And, you know, look, there's this old Heinrich Heine, the German poet, had this joke about Jews. He said, the Jews are like everyone else, just more so. So I think, right? And I think this pandemic is making everyone more so, you know?
Right.
So if you escaped with, you know,
you brought up the Germans and I think they're coming in for an attack right now.
Yeah, of course.
Right over my house.
I heard that. If, you know, if you were a person who sought comfort in carbs before, it's even more so now. If you were a person who, to deal with anxiety was gobbling edibles and drinking scotch or bourbon, you're doing it even more now. If you were a person for whom shopping was your sort of comfortable band-aid over your lack of control, those Amazon boxes are showing up
There's not a moment that goes by where my wife has not bought something, and it can be a $2 tweezer.
Yes.
It doesn't matter.
It's about the process. It's about the process. And so I think that, yes, I think this is making everyone and everything more extreme. I don't think it's giving anyone a new personality. I think it's enhancing the personality we already have, much like death, by the way. Much like death, when people confront death, it doesn't give you a new personality. It intensifies the personality you already have.
If you're a right mind, if I'm sure you're with many Alzheimer's people, your dad.
Well, but
and
what I'm saying is not only about the dying, but the family who's surrounding, you know, the caretaker is more of a caretaker. The joker jokes more, the feeder feeds more, the hugger hugs more, you know, the depressed person gets more depressed.
Are people having more sex during this time?
I only know about two of the people you're referring to. So I would say nothing really gives anyone a new personality, Bob.
Well, my daughters have been visiting, you know, and that kind of is...
That'll do it.
Well, that'll stop you. That'll keep you from, you don't go hide in closets if your kid's in the house.
Yeah, yeah. I thought you were out of the closet, Bob.
I'm way out. I'm hetero, but I could have gone any direction.
Yeah, I didn't know.
And my parents would have been okay with whatever I am. Something I love about you, I mean, we got to know each other a little bit through our friend that passed.
Yes.
And you never get over the grieving. And a lot of people are losing people now. A lot of people. And it's interesting. I'm finding it's not. A lot is COVID related, and some is just a dear friend. Her mom just died of cystic fibrosis after a 3-year fight. I mean, it seems to be a timing of a lot of change and pain for many, many people. And that's why this book, which I've already talked about before we started, is so beautiful and so significant for people to read, because it's made for humanity. It's not made for a Jewish person. There are jokes in it that are fantastic. In fact, before we get into anything seriously heavy, although we did, because I just have to read this joke because it's such a good joke.
Go ahead.
And of course it plays as a good soundbite. So you've gone into a lot of rooms where people are leaving, and you have tried to bring them solace. And through this book, you talk about your philosophy of how you do what you do, and humor, Norman Cousins, humor is, it's gigantic, right?
Well, it is the indicator to me, if I can call myself a death professional, and unfortunately I am.
Yes.
But I know this even from the Holocaust, where there were jokes. There are anthologies of Holocaust humor. Now, what does this tell us? First of all, I know, and this just happened literally 15 minutes ago, Bob, when I was Zooming with a family to prepare them for a funeral that's coming later this week. Their 65-year-old father and husband and son dropped dead of a massive heart attack.
Oh, my God.
I knew when I got them to laugh, when I got them to reminisce and laugh, even though they're not necessarily aware of this consciously, I know that laughter is the subconscious decision to survive, to move forward. We are going to be okay. The bottom has not fallen out of the world. To me, when you're talking about grief and death, that's what laughter indicates, that this is a person, this is a family that is going to make it. Because to laugh is to choose life, really.
And it's also the reason I do comedy. The reason it happened inherently is we had so much loss in our lives. And my dad lost his 4 siblings, ended up being 5 siblings. And he would just crack the most inappropriate jokes at their funerals. It didn't matter. He just did it. And
it was his way of saying, this is not the end for all of us, right?
It's looking outside of it all. It takes you outside just for a moment. And
that's right.
And I just want to share this joke because I never heard this joke. And you put it in the book, and it's in a chapter called Showing Up.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just showing up. I have someone in my family that I love very, very much, and is not sure that I'm there when I'm there. But it's showing up. It's being there when a person...
Walk in the door. Yeah, people ask me all the time, Steve, I'm going to visit my friend from college who's been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. He's got 3 months. I'm flying back east to visit him. What do I say? And my answer is just walk in the door and
right.
be, be, but it's not just walk in the door. It's walk in the door and be your authentic self. Don't walk in the door with some long drawn face and some bad acting job. What people who are dying need and the grieving need is for you to be with them in death, who and what you were with them in life, because that is reassuring. That says not everything has changed and not everything is gone. So you don't want to walk in with this long face and, you know, oh, Bob, it's so awful. And I'm so down with you. And
we've
let's
had a lot of that.
Yeah. It's, you want to be, as I said before, you know, if you're a hugger, hug, if you're a joker, joke. I remember at Brad's Shiva, you told a hilarious story about being in the jacuzzi with him. And let me tell you, that comforted all of us a lot more.
And his children. And I've talked about it more with them. I've been talking to them. His birthday just came up. It's been 5 years, I believe.
And
it doesn't seem like
5 years.
When people die, it doesn't seem
like... It's a different dimension. It's a different dimension of time. But my point is that actually being who you really always were in that family is comforting. If you came in with a new personality, it's one more insult to their loss. So you got to walk
in. I'm not capable of that, you know.
People do it. People pretend.
I've noticed, and it really always bothered me when someone's in a coma, and I talk to people in a coma. I'm sure you completely believe in that because they're there. And if they're not, they're nearby, I'd like to believe.
Yes.
Sometimes maybe not. They've checked out and they're gone because they wanted to get away from their wife that bad. But that's a time where people sometimes go, we got you some soup. We got, oh, and Jimmy's here.
Yeah.
And they talk like, and they do it with children too. They'll do it. If you talk to a three-year-old, like, do you want some candy? That three-year-old will go, I want candy, rather than going, I'd like some candy at 4 years old. It's tonally how we teach people. There's no reason to send them out by talking at them.
And the truth is, if you are authentic, you don't have to worry about what to say or how to be, because you already know. This is what I tell people when they say, what do I say to my friend from college? I say, you already know how to be with that person. Just walk through the door. I'll tell you, Bob, even after 33 plus years of standing on front doorsteps or standing in the hallway outside a hospital room, even after all these years, I don't know exactly what I'm going to say when I walk in the door. All I know is I have to walk through the door and be myself.
Well, you have a gift at that. You have a very special gift, because a person to be able to do a eulogy, a wedding ceremony, a birth, deaths are very prevalent. To be able to do it because you found out the information you need about the person, you know the close people, and then recite it, that's what you're born to do. That's how you... How did you find... I want to do this joke, but who cares? Okay, I'll do the joke.
Come on.
Three elderly women are sitting by the pool at their assisted living residence. One of them notices an elderly man napping on a lounge chair flat on his belly and totally naked except for a towel over his face and another over his privates. I like that you said privates. Who's that? One woman asks her two friends. I don't know, one of them answers. Let's go find out. They walk over to the sleeping man. One of the women gently lifts the towel from the waist, takes a look, replaces the towel, and says, it's not my husband. The second woman also gingerly lifts the towel, examines the naked man, puts the towel back in place, and says, it's not my husband either. Finally, the third woman lifts the towel from the man's waist, takes a long, careful look, puts the towel back, shrugs, and says, he doesn't even live in the complex. Now, that means that she has been with every single man in the complex.
She's seen them all.
Now, an older lady in that irreverent Betty White type of comedy voice, which is about as old as comedy. You know, you get great comedian actresses.
Minnie Pearl.
Minnie Pearl. Even Moms Mabley would have told that joke.
Yeah.
You know, there it crosses.
Joan Rivers could have told that joke.
Oh, definitely. But she wouldn't have wanted to be associated. She would have told the joke, but not been one of the older ladies.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
But it just made me laugh because it's a little lascivious. But beside that, it's just allowing that little bit of whatever people call PG or appropriate or not canceled kind of humor.
Yeah.
It really lets the air out. And it also brings in younger people that think all you're telling is puns and parables.
Yeah.
I mean, you're a rabbi. I don't know if you know that, but it says it right here. It says you're a rabbi, but it doesn't say, you didn't put Rabbi Steve Leader on here.
No, because I felt that if I put Rabbi Steve Leader on the cover of the book, there would be a very large percentage of people who would see that and say, well, I'm sure it's a great book, but it's not for me. And because death is the common denominator in all of life, I wanted the book to be as accessible and universal as possible. And I didn't want to put anything on the cover that would say to anyone, you know, this isn't really for you, because it really is for everyone. And I do have a unique perspective, but, and I think you know this from comedy, the more particular you are, the more universal the truth is that you're revealing.
Yeah.
You know, the way I think of it is the tiniest particles, the tinier you get, the more micro you get, you're actually getting down to the level of particles that are common to all matter. Right? So I think that comedy is like this, and I think our life stories are like this. The more particular I can be, the more universal the truth is that I'm revealing. I think it was Blake who said, in a drop of water, you can see the ocean. And so this book is really intended, obviously, to be written from my perspective, but a perspective that hopefully enlightens everyone who reads it.
Well, it's interesting because so many people are not even sure what God is right now, and don't want to believe in God. Other people believe are devout Christians, and they find wonderful solace in that. Judaism has been something that I've come in and out of throughout my life. I guess I would say I'm not agnostic or atheist, but I have many friends that are.
Mm-hmm.
I like to believe that there's a universal energy that we're all connected, which is very close to Judaism.
Yeah, and you know what? I think, just to go a little deeper on this, and you can.
But we're not going to talk about politics or religion.
you may cut this because it might be too wonky. But what I really think is going on, Bob, I've had hundreds, maybe thousands of people say to me over the years, "I don't believe in God," and I say, "That's fine. What do you believe in?" And every single time, Bob, they go on to articulate some very sophisticated theological point of view. What they're uncomfortable with is the word God. So what I think we actually have here is not a theological problem, but a psycholinguistic problem.
Yeah, because, semantics.
Yes, because we feel, when we say the word God in English, we feel like we sound like people with whom we don't agree. You know, so I say to people, okay, what do you believe in? And they'll say what you said. For example, I believe in a collective energy. Some people say I believe in nature. Some people will say I believe in the collective beauty of humanity. Some people will say I believe in science. And I said, well, that's what I mean when I say God. So, you know, like, this is a pen. You can call it a Bic. You can call it a writing instrument. I don't care what you call
it. You can say it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Because that's where we're at right now.
Yeah.
But we have people that will say that.
About the same thing.
Right.
And that's where I come down when it comes to God. I'm telling you, I've had 12-year-olds who don't want to have their bar mitzvah say to me, I don't believe in God. And I say, well, what do you believe in? And they believe in plenty. And it's deep.
There are people, right now we're dealing with a huge rise, and it'll always be here, but right now, anti-Semitism is at a pretty big high. Or do you disagree with that?
I do. I think what's at a pretty big high is the amount of media attention given to a relatively small number of anti-Semites. You know, the news cycle now
It's in search of hate.
It's in search of hate. It's 24/7, and it's on thousands of platforms. Because everybody with a Facebook page or an Instagram is now a media platform, essentially. So I think what we have here, because really historically, if you chart it, anti-Semitism in America today is nothing near what it was in the 40s and 50s or the 30s and 20s. Nowhere close.
It's the same as segregation. As painful as racism is across the gamut, and as much as we've gone through in the summer of 2020 and currently now in the rebuttal of the summer of 2020 and in defense of human rights, it's still the needle painfully gets moved forward.
It does. And I also think that there's a trap you can fall into, because when you start looking at anti-Semitism, sometimes making more of it gets you more attention, raises more money for your organization, gets people stirred up, when it's generally more smoke than fire. Now, I am not for a moment dismissing the real nature of anti-Semitism in this country.
Right.
But that being said, if anyone ever said to you, Bob, where and when in all of human history would you like to be born as a Jew? You know what you should say?
I guess right now, the answer to everything, and it's throughout this book.
Yeah, is, right here, right now.
And anybody wise that I get to talk to in my life says the moment is the most important thing. This moment right now. And it's throughout this entire book. The book is made to be a book that you have by your bed.
Well, it's
no
a
matter
field
what, book. If you had a book about Jesus, if you had Deepak Chopra, if you had Eckhart Tolle, whatever you have, this is one of those books.
It was meant to be two things. I'm so glad you said that, because I really hoped it would be two things. One, which is what you're talking about, is a field guide for people who are encountering death, grief, loss, mourning, to help them understand and navigate from where they are through the journey. Like, where am I? What do I do? What do I say? What do I ask? Are these feelings productive or unproductive? So definitely it's a field guide, and the size is built. It's manufactured to be a field guide. And the other part of the book, which hopefully is artfully these two woven together, that was the hardest part about writing the book, was weaving these two narratives together, is the exploration of my journey from Steve Leader, the rabbi, to Steve Leader, the son, through my father's journey of 10 years through Alzheimer's and ultimately death.
And that's what this is. That's what personalizes it. And that's what I relate to. I wrote a book called Dirty Daddy, and it was dedicated to my dad. And it was about, and my mom, because she passed soon after, before it was published. But it was about, we have a lot in common. My dad never played sports with me. Your dad never played sports with you. You mentioned
he threw a baseball like a girl. That says it all.
Wait a second. Pardon me for correcting you, but I know many women that throw a better baseball.
Let me just tell you. He threw a baseball like a girl in the 1960s.
It was okay to say he threw a baseball like a girl.
When I was a little kid. Believe me, I've watched women's softball. I understand what you're saying. But when I was a little boy.
I just have to be careful, because every second either of us can be canceled.
Yes, yes, yes. When I was a little boy, girls generally did not play baseball or Little League. And they were very adept at sports boys were not adept at. But there was a real separation there between boys sports and girls sports. And, as I say in the book, my dad was such a complicated person, because he knew nothing about sports.
Did he watch it with you? Did you watch the Super Bowl?
Never once.
When I was a little girl, I'm trying to pull out of that. When I was a little girl, my dad and I, we didn't watch sports. It was interesting at his Shiva. And for people who don't know what that is, it's when someone passes away. Shiva means Delhi. it just means,
No, it doesn't.
No, it does. A bris is when you cut the penis tip off, but they replace it with a platter of tongue and corned beef. So that's basically our tradition. But at my dad's shiva, at my home, where I had many wonderful people, dear friends and family, and some people, I wanted to talk to you about this. Some people would come up to my dad because you mentioned this, and they went, look at that.
It's okay.
They would come up to me. Isn't that funny how it does take you when it's that personal?
It's kind of beautiful too.
Yeah, because he's alive when I talk about it.
Yeah, and you see yourself in him. It's beautiful.
I see him right. Here he is. I happen to have a
let me see.
This is the actual size of his head. Ben Saget.
That's great. I love the stash too.
Oh, he had a whole Boris Badenoff thing going. But people would come up to me and they'd go, "How am I going to live without him?" I go, "You know, I don't know. He's my dad."
You figure it out. Yeah.
My friend Norm MacDonald, who's hilarious, one of the funniest people alive, has a story he tells, which is true. He's at his father's wake. The body is in the living room. Somebody comes over and they say to him, and I can't do it honor it deserves. They say to him, "Would you like a sandwich?" Because they see that he's suffering. And he goes, I don't know. There's kind of a dead guy here. I don't think I want a sandwich. I mean,
yeah, I don't want to eat.
I mean, have you noticed there's a dead guy here? And I don't do it justice. But
it's part of the denial of death that people do to children particularly. And they do children a terrible disservice.
By not explaining.
And not facing it and not sitting with it.
Because everyone's afraid of it.
Yeah, let me tell you where it starts. Listen to this. You know how many parents, when the kid's goldfish dies, they flush it and go run and get a new one and put it in the bowl so the kid never knows it died? What an injustice to that child. What a missed opportunity.
My mother made gefilte fish out of it. My mother would save all
just
the...
Just an appetizer.
She would say, "You can freeze anything." I want to come back and talk and laugh about death, but I have to go to a break real quick. So here we go from one of our sponsors that I'm sure will have something to do with the living. Okay, we're back. Isn't it great? This is the beauty of podcasts.
Yeah, and you're the TiVo of podcast.
And I'm talking to Steve Leader, who has written a book, and it's The Beauty of What Remains, which is also a beautiful, all your titles are beautiful. I mean, you've written The Extraordinary Nature of Ordinary Things, More Money Than God, Living a Rich Life Without Losing Your Soul, and the bestseller, More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. And this byline on this one is how our greatest fear becomes our greatest gift.
Yes.
And death, I don't know how I accomplished it. I think it was a lot of deaths that I'd been through in my life. My parents, my sisters, all my cousins, my uncles, friends, all much too young, 37-year-old uncles, 41-year-old, 42, young. And therapy helped me quite a bit. And also people that cared about me helped me.
You know, you're making a very important point that I think as a service to your listeners is worth shedding a little light on. The Talmud says the prisoner cannot free himself. That's such a powerful thought. The prisoner cannot free himself. And you, in the depths of your grief, had the maturity at a young age to reach out for help. And
I didn't get it. I didn't get it because the help I got was the humor from my dad, and my mother was kind of sweeping the pain under the rug because there was so much of it. I'm surprised they lived each to 89 and made it.
But at some point you got therapy, you leaned on your friends, you reached out for help, and people reached back and they lifted you from the suffering. And that's so important. You know, I have studied and written and lived and thought a great deal about all forms of pain and loss.
Right.
And I can tell you with absolute certainty that no one suffers pain better alone. No one. I'll give you one interesting scientific example. They did an experiment years ago where they had subjects put their feet in a bucket of ice water, and they timed how long the person could keep his or her feet in the ice water, how long they could withstand the pain. And they were alone in the room. Then they did
just Jewish people or anybody?
No, all kinds of people. And then they ran the same experiment, but there was someone in the room with the subject when he or she put his or her feet in the ice bucket. They were able to keep their feet in the ice water almost twice as long when someone else was in the room, which is a very good indicator that we can endure things far better when we're in the company of other people.
My only argument against that would be waterboarding. Because when you see it in a Liam Neeson movie or in Homeland, waterboarding, which became so popular in movies.
You should be alone. Yes,
you should be alone. You don't want somebody pouring that down your throat.
I agree.
But the fear of death and worry, there's a lot about worry in here, huge amounts of it. And I do want to tell the listeners for a moment that don't know, because they're going, oh, this is Bob's Jewish podcast. They all are, if you have comedy in you, no matter what, or I don't know. That sounds profile-y, but there's a certain thing about humor that stems from the black and...
It stems from 3,000 years of oppression.
And that's why some of the best comedians in the world are black.
Because humor is
Jewish. So persecuted groups are the best.
It's the weapon of the powerless.
Italians are hilarious.
Italians, Bob? I say Italians are happy Jews.
Jews are miserable Italians.
Exactly.
So that's why ethnicity, if we cannot think it's racist to mention those things. Like Don Rickles did it in a way, and he was, as you know, a dear friend of myself and of Brad's, and just a love. And some people say his humor wouldn't float today. They don't know that he would adjust to now. He would adjust. He'd probably be more serious. And then he would still come in at the end.
He'd stick you at the end for sure.
And I always tell people about that Denzel Washington on David Letterman with Don Rickles, and Denzel's in the first three segments and he's poignant and amazing in Denzel. And then Don comes out and Denzel insists to sit there for Don's three segments. It's a six act show and it's beautiful. And when I talk to Don, all he would say in pure reverence, can you believe Denzel stayed? He wanted to, and Don was saying horrible things and Denzel was falling off the couch.
Racial stuff because
it's letting the air out of the pressure cooker, which now, if you read the transcript of things, you can't do it. You can't say it. So Steve, you were talking about the Talmud. And there's a lot of misinformation about that because it's I've read it. It's beautiful. I have it here in English so I could read it. And I used to think it was the first five books of Moses in the actual Old Testament, but it is not, is it?
No. The Talmud was written roughly 1,000 years after the Hebrew Bible was compiled. And
this is 4,000 years ago?
No, the Torah is roughly 3,000, and the Talmud began. We know that the sort of architecture, the internal architecture of the Talmud is a collection of debates between groups of legal rabbinical scholars, arguing and illuminating every single word.
Is it like reading the op-ed piece in the New York Times every week?
It's like reading a Supreme Court decision where the majority and minority opinions about legal issues are recorded. Because the Bible, we all know, is pretty bare bones and terse. I'll give you a small example of the difference between the Talmud and the Hebrew Bible. So the Hebrew Bible says, thou shalt do no work on the Sabbath, right? But that's all it says. Now, the Talmud is a whole conversation between scholars about, well, what's work?
Yeah. If, I mean, I was about to ask you that.
Right. So let's say if I'm,
Send emails.
No, if I'm a cabinet maker, then cabinet making is work. But what if I like to refinish furniture as a hobby? Is that work? So, you know, all these questions.
We call those loopholes now.
Right. Well, it is a legal tax. There is tax law in the Talmud too. So it fills in all the empty space left by the Bible. It's an amazing, over 5,000 pages. It was compiled over hundreds of years. And it is chock full of wisdom. Let me say this much about the literature of the ancient rabbis. There is nothing, not one aspect of the human condition that they didn't think through very deeply.
But things have changed. There are things that they would not suspect. Dictatorships.
Correct.
And
No, that's not true. The Roman emperor was a dictator. They did.
Oh, yeah, I heard about him.
There are certain things like, for example, impossible to discuss. For example, well, it says you're not supposed to light a fire on the Sabbath. What if it's a switch on your gas fireplace? Is that okay? You know, organ transplant, test tube babies. There are things that modernity has posed where you just have to look for precedent. But generally speaking, these men, and they were all men, deeply considered the human condition in all of its aspects. And a lot of what I do, Bob, is I just universalize this stuff. I bring it to people in a way that's accessible. That's what I do.
Steve, I have a question. Because of the Orthodox religion and keeping men separate from women, in the more, I guess, fundamental
Correct.
Ways of Judaism, it's the men's opinion. Do you feel, I know you're probably not supposed to talk about this, but that it should have been done by women as well? I mean, in this modern society, for them to speak for womankind seems crazy, doesn't it?
Yeah, you have to
be very careful, Steve.
No, you have to think.
You're a very famous Jew.
Yeah, it's pretty simple, really. You have to think about it from two different perspectives, from the inside and the outside perspective. From the inside perspective, and I know many, many, obviously, Orthodox families and lots of Orthodox women, some of whom I work with in our synagogue. From their perspective, whether it would be yours or not, whether you agree with it or not, their view is we have separate but equally important roles in perpetuating the values and the faith of our people. Now, that's from inside. From the outside, it looks like good old-fashioned sexism.
Right.
And the truth is, it's both. It depends on whether you're on the inside of it or the outside of it. If you're Amish and you're a believer, this role separation and differentiation isn't sexist. It's productive. It's meaningful for both. Each have their role to play. You know, all mammals, by the way, have a gender-based division of labor. That's how we survive as a species. So, you know, if you're on the inside of it, it makes perfect sense. From the outside, it makes very little sense. And the truth is, I think that this dichotomous tension between modernity and tradition is so important for driving the entire enterprise forward. I think they're both important. We see this in our own society with Supreme Court justices. Do we want a strict literalist, or do we want somebody who's going to apply these principles to modernity? And the truth is, I think there's room for both.
There has to be.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I think for people for whom it's a meaningful lifestyle, God bless them. And I think it's good for the world. For people who find it offensive and go a different route, you know, I'm part of the more liberal Jewish community, obviously. For me, it doesn't work for me. It wouldn't work for my daughter. Wouldn't work for my wife. But if it does work for you, I have no critique to offer any more than I would of the Amish. This is their world, and it's a beautiful world. It's just not my world.
Right, because I do want to be able to take vaccines and
Jews, Orthodox Jews take vaccines and medicine.
But Amish, do Amish take vaccines?
I don't know. I'm not an expert on the Amish.
I've got to do that. I've got to find a great Amish leader.
It would be interesting, wouldn't it?
All I have to go on is the movie Witness with Harrison Ford. That's my whole thing.
Yeah.
Is that an Amish murder? Was there a murder?
No,
there
he's accused of murder and they shelter him. They hide him.
Oh, so they helped an accused murder.
Yes, correct.
Well, they're helping Harrison Ford. They're okay. This is gorgeous, something that you wrote. And it's a quote from somebody that we all admire, Albert Einstein, who said a couple of great things. Not Albert Brooks, whose original name was Einstein, who also said many great things. Albert Einstein supposedly said, now that's interesting that you would use that word. So is it because it wasn't transcribed and he didn't declare it?
You wouldn't know this about me, but I actually wrote my rabbinical thesis on Albert Einstein. I at one point, I mean, this was 33 plus years ago, 34 years ago. So I don't, you know, I've lost some of what I knew for sure. But at one point, I probably knew more about Einstein than any other rabbi in the world because I wrote my thesis on him. And I could never document this quote. It's attributed to him, but I could never find it. So that's why I said he allegedly said.
And what he allegedly said was, there are only two ways to live your life. One is as though nothing is a miracle. The other is as though everything is a miracle.
Yes.
And then then you say, never do I feel the miracle of life more so than in the face of death. Right. And I'm sure you also feel it in the face of birth as well.
Yes, correct. Yes.
So one is as though nothing is a miracle, and the other is everything is a miracle.
Yeah. If you are a religious person, a spiritual person, and spirituality is a word that has lost its currency because it's overused, but I can tell you what I think it means. To me, to be a spiritual person is to grasp the sanctity, the holiness of the mundane. You know, why do Jews, in fact, almost all religions have a blessing over bread, the simplest, most humble of foods? Why?
Not as much because of the carbs.
We're
trying to lay off of the challah these days.
Not me. Why over bread? Because if you can be grateful for that, then you're grateful for the many larger blessings in your life, right? So to me, to be a spiritual person is to understand there's no such thing as a small miracle. Think about those words, juxtapose, small miracle. If it's a miracle, it's not small at all.
How do you define a miracle? How do you define that? That, for example, in this siege on the Capitol, religion and politics, yay, or law breaking, that it could have been so much worse. As bad as it was, and as sad as it is, it could have been.
Well, let me tell you, that's why I think it was more. Now, I'm not dismissing the tragedy of five deaths. And
not at all. What it was.
Right. However, it was, in my opinion, much more stunt than premeditated coup. Because if that was really a coup, they could have gone in there and shot 400 plus Congress people, three of whom were next in line for the presidency, and they could have done real damage to our system. And that's a coup. That's a coup.
And now, as we're recording this, we don't know, because this will be on shortly after, but we don't know what's going to transpire between now and, you know, all of what's happening, which is history. Major American history is happening. And
But to your point about what is a miracle, you know, I see this on a much less societal and much more individual level. You know, I'm going to show you something. This is a prayer that I say every morning when I wake up. And this is a prayer that expresses gratitude for my body and the way it works, that I have a body, that I'm a corporeal being. I'm not an inanimate object. And that my body works. I mean, this is a prayer that talks about the miracle that our openings open and our closings close, which sounds funny until you have an opening that doesn't open or a closing that doesn't close. And that's a stroke or an embolism or a heart attack.
Or a tumor.
And you're dead. And so to me, the elevating of the mundane. You know, in Judaism, you're going to eat a strawberry. There's a blessing for that. You're going to drink a glass of grape juice. There's a blessing for that. You see the sunrise. There's a blessing for that. And to me, ultimately, it's about gratitude, because it is very hard to be depressed if you are grateful.
And
everything
yet it's very,
you're grateful.
You're right. You're 1,000,000% right. But now more than ever, because of this quarantine, because of 9 months of people that have stayed in, and then the people that have not, there's a different kind of righteous indignation that has gotten them through this time. And yet it is easier for many to be depressed and harder to punch out of the bag and somehow not be depressed.
We have to count our blessings. Okay. There's a,
how do you tell that to someone? And I'm not at all trying to start anything. How do you tell that to someone that has no food on their table and just got evicted?
Well, I'm not
there's
saying
blood in their veins. There's oxygen in their lungs. I've still got my child in my arms.
And there are people willing to help.
But people are hopeless and don't think they can find someone. There's so many disenfranchised.
But they can. They can. Remember that phrase, the prisoner cannot free himself. You have to reach out. And there's this legend. It's a legend. It's ahistorical. There was a plague during the time of King David, and 100 people were dying a day. So King David issues a decree that everyone in the kingdom has to count 100 blessings today, each day, as a counterweight to the 100 deaths. And according to the legend, the plague stopped. Now, it's obviously just a legend, but there is something curative or healing. Let's not say curative. There is something very healing about counting your blessings, about this is why I call the book The Beauty of What Remains. We're all suffering tremendous loss right now, not just death. We've lost our freedom. We've lost our sense of invulnerability. We've lost the right for our kids to go to school where they belong. We've lost jobs. We've lost money. We've lost health. We have lost the most fundamentally beautiful thing about being human, which is to touch and hold and be held by others that we love. I have an 87-year-old mother in Minneapolis. I haven't hugged my mother in a year.
Do you want me to hug her?
We've all lost so much.
Yeah.
And it's easy to focus only on the loss instead of the beauty that remains. And by the way, some of that beauty, now here's really the deeper point. Some of that beauty has been created as a result of the loss.
That's correct. And some of the justice will come out of the loss. These things have a energy that's reverse of what's been put out. If it's
that's exactly right. And so
with anger comes anger, and then eventually it has to dissipate. Otherwise, it escalates till
there's reconciliation. So just to get, we'll go on a little mind trip now. There's a theological term called via negationis, by way of the negative. It's Latin. And what it is is a school of theology that says you can understand what God is by deciding what God is not.
Right.
Okay? Now, let's apply this broader. Think, for example, of the most beautiful marble sculpture you can think of, the most beautiful sculpture you've ever seen in any museum. Now, think about how that sculpture began. It began as a solid block of marble. That beauty was always within that block of marble. It was hiding in plain sight. But in order for that beauty to emerge, to be revealed, things had to be taken away, had to be removed.
Right.
It's the taking away that enables that beauty to emerge. For me, I'll speak only personally. Despite the suffering and the fear, and I have a wife who's twice immunocompromised, my mom got COVID in the nursing home. We've had plenty of trouble in our family because of this. My son lost his job 2 weeks into this thing. He's living with us now. I'm not telling you that suffering isn't suffering.
Right. And wisdom comes through suffering, which was said by, I think, Aeschylus. Yeah. I'm not sure.
And I'm also telling you that loss is also a type of gain, because what has happened for me, at least during this pandemic, is so many beautiful things have emerged because I have stopped certain behaviors, not started certain behaviors. I've stopped running around on the 405 and the 10 to get to a stupid meeting to sit with five people I could have Zoomed with. Right. I've stopped wearing uncomfortable clothes. I've stopped being out breakfast, lunch, and dinner with people to fundraise who I don't really care about very much. I'm home for dinner.
Well, they're going to know that now because of the podcast.
You're that big. I miss so many opportunities to cook with my wife and bake with my daughter. I miss so many opportunities to just sit on the couch with my family. And also, I don't know about you, Bob, but I have found, as a result of the pandemic, the words "I love you" flow so much more easily from my lips and my heart now.
We are saying it to each other in ways, people that I'm doing the podcast with, that I now have a real connection with, that I knew but just met them.
Yeah.
Some real genuine friends.
Yeah.
I was on the phone yesterday with Gilbert Gottfried, who's gotten in a lot of trouble for things he said as a comedian.
Yeah.
And he's a sweetheart of a man, and he's not emotional, and he keeps his mouth quiet about emotions. He's got two young children and a beautiful wife, Dara, and he wasn't feeling that good. And I called him to see how he was doing. And I said to him, "I love you, Gilbert." And he said, "I love you, Bob." And I went, "Gilbert, I'm so sorry that I made you go there. I know you don't do that. I don't know what came over me. It's just where I'm at." And he went, no. And he was giggling. Yeah. He was like, we're like little kids, Bob, together. His wife said he doesn't tell her he loves her. She says, "I love you." He says, "I hate you."
That is the power of the stripping away.
Yeah.
The pandemic brings a kind of beautiful essentialism to life. Beautiful.
And that is a miracle, that love can be pushed through all this pain. And unfortunate, you watch the media, it's all hatred.
Yeah.
Well, it truly is all hatred.
But the media is not life. I mean, the media is a performance. It's entertainment.
And there's good people everywhere. On there trying to say, there's good people everywhere.
Yeah, but this is what death also does, not just a pandemic, but death also wakes us up to the beauty and the power and the profundity and the joy and the laughter and the pleasure of life. And, and that's what we need to embrace and hold on to, because that is the stuff of life itself. That's the reason to be alive.
Which is a gift while we have it.
Yes.
And that's what this book is about. And we're going to take one more break just to, and we're going to talk about how great death is a little bit more. I do want to say that January 28th, people want to, if they're enjoying this right now, the Stryker Center and Temple Emmanuel in New York are doing a wonderful discussion about your book, The Beauty of What Remains, and I get to talk with you again, and it will be live. And it is on the 28th, and they can go to the Stryker Center, Stryker, and I'm sure it's strykercenter.com, and find out how they can participate and get into the Zoom, I don't know what you'd call it, conversation that we're going to have that will bring up some of these things we're talking about, but probably in a different way. You'll probably be more formally dressed, I bet. I bet you have a sport coat on.
No, but I'll have a collared shirt on. In your
I wore the collared shirt, but you can't tell because of this. But you won't see my cords. I'll be very, very, I'll be cordless.
You're an entertainment professional, Bob.
Oh, I'm trying. What's interesting is you chose, how did you choose Wilshire Boulevard Temple? You were a junior rabbi there, and then eventually inherited the congregation.
Yeah. So coming out of rabbinical school is a little bit like coming out of law school in the sense that any synagogue looking for a young associate comes to the campus. They interview all the seniors who are graduating. Rabbinical school is, by the way, 5 years after your BA, you go for 5 years. And so, you know, 30, 40 congregations come to the college and they interview all the graduating seniors. If they like you, they fly you out. You have some more interviews. And then there's a 3-day period where they can offer you a job. So I flew all over the country, went to a lot of places. And I'll tell you, my childhood rabbi called me just before the interviews began. And he said, "Steve, I just want to remind you, there are three things that matter in your first job as a rabbi: the senior rabbi, the senior rabbi, and the senior rabbi." Right? You have to work for someone who will teach you and whom you respect.
Right.
So I interviewed with all these senior rabbis who were looking for associates, and they were interviewing me, but I was also interviewing them. And the senior rabbi at the time of Wilshire Boulevard Temple was a beautiful guy named Harvey Fields. And I felt of all the guys I interviewed with, and they were all guys back then, I felt that I would learn the most from him. In fact, I asked him, "What kind of rabbi will I be after 5 years of being with you?" And he said, "You will be a rabbi who will be qualified to go run any synagogue in the country." So I thought, that's my guy.
Right.
Because he really wants to train me. And it turned out that I stayed working with Harvey and a few other rabbis for 16 years. And then they made me the senior rabbi in 2000, I think it was. 2003, I became the senior rabbi. And I am the only person from my graduating class in rabbinical school who is still in the same congregation where he began. I'm the only one. It's very unusual, very unusual.
So you've watched these families for how many years now?
33 plus years, you know. And so for me, it's a very rich experience because I, for example, do weddings for hundreds of kids whose bar bat mitzvahs I did, whose baby namings I did.
Do divorces? Because I remember my ex-wife and I, we had to get a get. And I said they should call it a take. And at the time I had an office in Santa Monica, and I shared office space area with Marsha Herskovitz and Ed Zwick, who did 30-something in My So-Called Life and Once and Again. He's wonderful, and they're great director, great producers, both of them. And they signed my get.
Your get, yeah.
Because I figured two gentlemen that deal strictly with writing about relationships and how good or badly they can go are the perfect people. It was my one showbiz Jewish moment that was significant.
I don't do them, but I sent people to rabbis who do create those documents.
Right, so you don't, that's interesting. Do you do it by choice because you want to concentrate on the things of bringing people together and positiveness?
Yes, yeah, yes. I want to be Switzerland, you know, that's my role. So I try
to- Can I hide money with you?
Yeah, of course, of course, of course, yeah. So, you know, I am the only one left. It's been my craft and my job. For me, Wilshire Boulevard Temple, as I like to put it, first of all, it's an amazing, amazing collection of people. Just amazing, brilliant, talented, soulful, great people. Also, I'm a very ambitious person, and most synagogues are not very ambitious. And the culture is a good fit for me because it's a place that's large enough to be bold and do new and interesting things, but just small enough that I can actually get it to maneuver in the direction we want it to go, you know? So for me, it's been a really, really, really good marriage. It's a lot of work because it's one of the largest synagogues in the world. But for me, it's been a very gratifying experience.
It's wonderful. And you're able to do something that only great spiritual clergy can do, which is the gift of what great broadcasters can do or great speakers or great humans can do, which is talk to as many people, whether it be one or a million and thousands, and it's as though it's a conversation with one person. It's the personalization of you sharing of yourself, and it's the same in comedy. I mean, it just is that. It's personal.
You know, I came like you, and maybe in some ways more so, I don't know, because it's not a contest, but I came from very humble, beginnings.
Same. We didn't have much.
Very modest, very humble.
Well, your dad was a junkyard man.
Yeah. My dad and my uncle owned a junkyard. Yeah.
Which is Sanford and Son, so they would walk around. I have a picture of Red Fox and Rodney Dangerfield.
I know. My dad loved All in the Family and Sanford and Sons.
Yeah.
I never saw my father laugh harder. I saw my father laugh really hard a few times in my life. One I recount in the book. He used to laugh.
Is that Blazing Saddles?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Which Mel Brooks says he couldn't do it today.
No, he'd be canceled.
But if you watch it, and you know it was written for Richard Pryor, so there's five writers, and of course Mel and my friend Norman Steinberg, who I love, and brilliant writers, and Richard was one of the writers, and it was written to be just the opposite.
Yeah, the white guys are the idiots.
Yes, he's outsmarting all of them, and he looks to camera. Cleavon Little looks to camera like, can you believe this?
Yeah, he says, I am so good, and they are so dumb.
And that, but because of some of the other, because it presented racism.
Yeah.
It was
of a time, and I don't want to get into cancel culture, but I think it's gone unreasonably far. I think about what if 400 years from now or 300 years from now, the world has come to a place where eating animals, eating meat is considered to be ethically unconscionable and immoral. Are they going to start tearing down statues of people who ate meat 400 years before?
Well, I'll have to get rid of this, which my dad was in the meat business.
There you go.
That is where our lives were. All the jokes were about cows and chickens because that's what he did for a living, for a supermarket chain.
In any case, I think that my ability to speak plainly comes from, you know, there were seven of us in a 2-bedroom, 1-bathroom house. We all worked in the junkyard. My parents got married at 17 and 18. They didn't go to college. If you were arrogant, you paid a terrible price for arrogance in my family.
Right.
It wasn't appropriate. And the ideal in my family was to stay one step behind the Joneses, not ahead of the Joneses, because to be ambitious in that way was not appropriate, you know? So I think it all kind of added up. And the other thing is, I was very lucky. The one thing my father really believed in spending money on, well, there were two things, food and education. And I was privy to an excellent education. I was in the writing program at Northwestern University. And
did you have any idea that at that time that you would be a rabbi?
Yeah.
Yo, you knew at 15.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read your book.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. I decided at 15 I wanted to be a rabbi, but I knew that knowing how to write well and communicate well would be important. And what I learned at Northwestern and in honing it afterwards was was how to write to be heard rather than read. Because most of my work is sermons. And so I learned how to make things simple without making them simplistic. And I think that's so important. Those two things, to be able to write to be heard, not read, which means generally speaking, short, stubby sentences, proper phrasing, pausing, repetition, refrain. These things are all very important because they're
connection with it. And that's what a lot of people are turned off to all religion. because it's just going through the motions. When you see a wonderful reverend or a wonderful rabbi or a wonderful clergy person of any faith connect so deeply, and it's love rhetoric and it's healing rhetoric, you're in. It doesn't mean you'll make that yours. Go ahead. You're channeling.
And I'm channeling those great foundational stories of all of Western civilization. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, Leah, Moses, David. I mean, these are not just Jewish foundational stories and myths. And let's remember, a myth is not a lie. A myth is a way of describing a truth, right? There's a big difference between, you know, sometimes people say, how do you believe everything in the Bible? I said, I don't read the Bible for its facts. I read it for its truths, right?
It's Joseph Campbell, The Power of the Myth.
The myth, exactly right, exactly.
Because
right.
The myth is applicable. That's right. Why is Star Wars so popular?
Right.
Because a lot of it was lifted from Joseph Campbell.
Well, who lifted it from ancient religion.
Yeah.
Light and darkness, good and evil, the dichotomous tension within all of us. You know, Solzhenitsyn, in his Gulag trilogy, said the line between good and evil is not a line between us and them. It's a line that runs down the middle of each one of us.
That is incredibly poignant.
Yeah.
Say that one more time. I like that.
The line between good and evil is not a line between us and them. It's a line that runs down the middle of each one of us.
And I think many of us are dealing with that right now, because when you have vengeance in mind or revenge in mind for another side, for someone that doesn't believe what you believe, you're creating such inner turmoil in yourself. That's why so many people, I'm sure you speak to people every hour, that aren't sleeping. They're not sleeping just because of the pandemic. They're not sleeping because of the state of the world.
I have never heard of so many people gobbling edibles at night to go to sleep in my life.
I can't do them because it's like locked in syndrome. What if there's a raccoon on the roof and I have to get out my pop gun? I was attacked, Steve, by a raccoon last night, and I have a little pellet gun.
In your dreams or in reality?
In the yard. And my wife and my daughter and her fiance, we were all in the den looking at it, and it came down and it was going to do its thing.
Why did you go outside, Bob?
I opened the door I threw an orange at it, and then I looked it up and it says their favorite thing is fruit.
Then
I threw a potato at it, looked it up. Guess what their third favorite thing is? Potatoes, vodka. That's what I had. And then I have a pellet gun because it's a tiny little BB. It's not going to hurt anybody. And I hit it. One shot, one thing in the paw. And it literally looked at me, looked at its paw. It wasn't bleeding. It licked it a little bit. I was worried about it at this point. So this is that line right down the middle of me.
That's the good Bob.
Where I'm going, wait a minute. Elmer Fudd, bad Bob, went out and shot a raccoon with a pea-sized nothing. And the raccoon's looking at me like, what are you doing? It didn't move. Didn't move till I threw another potato at it, and then it just had a feast. But then I was able to turn back on. I have a motion detector rainbird, and that squirts it with water, and now it's gone from the yard. I didn't realize that wasn't working. So all of my life last night was the funniest comedic thing.
Raccoon Bob.
Oh, my God. It was Elmer Fudd stupidity, neurosis.
There is this, the older I get, the more I appreciate the value of the tension within us. And, you know, to go back to the Talmud for a minute, the rabbis see human beings in this way too. They say we all have two inclinations, an inclination for good and an inclination for evil. We are inclined for both. And this is the really brilliant part. And this is why the dark side is so important to embrace and understand. They say the greater the evil inclination, the greater the human being. Because your life's work becomes battling against your worst self in order for your best self to emerge.
And that's beautiful. What if you have someone like we're experiencing in present day with all id, who is not capable of empathy or guilt?
That is a failed human being.
So that darkness, like
that's in a failure
in a Hitler, is a person that had no compassion because it was all about his pain or ego.
That's a failure. And most likely, without getting overly psychoanalytic about it, a person who was starved of love and damaged at a very young age.
So we see that all over the world from people that behave that way.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I got a lot of love, but not always understanding, which made me an outsider.
Yeah, but if you had to choose.
You take the love.
Correct.
And everyone that's wise that I love says, go to where the love is.
Yeah.
And I know you've said that before.
Yeah.
What part of Blazing Saddles did your dad like the best? What was exactly that part?
The toll booth scene. The toll booth in the desert. When they're trying to slow down the bad guys, they put a toll booth in the middle of the desert. Easily could go around it 100 miles either direction, but they all line up right behind it. And then they don't have any dimes. So I think it was a Slim Pickens. He says, somebody go back and get a shit house, a shitter full of dimes. So they wait while somebody rides back to town, gets a bag of dimes, brings the dimes out. And then they each take a dime and they put it one at a time. And the arm goes up and down and each horse goes through. And for whatever reason, my father, it was at the Hopkins Theater in Minneapolis, Minnesota. My father was literally on the floor in our row of the theater, laughing, crying. It was a great moment.
And you shared that moment, and you always will have that moment.
I'll never forget
it. And that's it. That's in here.
And you know what? This is an example of there are no small miracles. That was such an ordinary, mundane even thing, seeing a movie with your dad. Okay. But that moment is one that I will never forget and that I can go to in my heart when I want to smile about my dad. And there are many. There are many moments
and
like that.
That's also that particular joke in all of Mel Brooks' movies are riddled with the jokes, as are all of our favorite comedian filmmakers, is that it's silly and yet it's a statement about what humankind does
and
to
stupidity,
follow the order.
The stupidity of the oppressor.
Yeah.
Which is a very strong dynamic in Jewish humor. You know, when you don't have the guns your enemies have, your humor enables you to outsmart them in your mind. And that's a very powerful weapon. And that's all we had. And we used it with great skill.
My friend Rodney Dangerfield, who's right over my shoulder, he said something to me, and I know he'd said it to other people as well, that show business is and trying to make something work and to get to kill with your stand up. Everything, it's always a life or death situation, and it's known that his stand up he would just crush. I mean,
he
didn't have a movie career till he was in Caddyshack at 58 years old. Some people don't know that. And he said, doing stand up, man, it's like being at the Nazi border and you're trying to get out of Germany and the guard says, give me your best 6 minutes.
Right.
And if you make him laugh, he goes, all right, go through.
And your
life depends on it. And if not, you die. You die.
You know, Bob, I think this is true. And I'm humbly putting myself in this category as a writer. I think this is true of all creative people.
Yeah.
I really do, that when you put forth something from your soul, your life does depend on it. You know, I wrote this book like my life depends. Like this is the last thing I'm ever going to be able to say to anyone about life.
And what if it's not going to happen, but what if it was? And I'm writing a script right now, and I've never written anything that flowed like this. It's just, I can't wait to get back and hit it. And I'm sure that's how this happened.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is. I locked myself in a cabin in Joshua Tree with nothing you know? And I wrote for months at a time. You know, I wrote for a month, took some time off, wrote for a month. I'm not a guy who can say, oh, I have 45 minutes free. I'm going to go work on chapter four. I need a long runway and I need to really be alone and really go deep. And this writing this book, you know, forced me to revisit a lot of sadness and to do it for a greater good, you know, which is to really help comfort people who are suffering from loss, not just from death, but loss of a loved one, but from all kinds of loss. But I think any of us who are creative, you're putting your heart on a platter.
Yeah.
And you're vulnerable. And that is a real act of faith and real hope and real love. This book is a gesture of my love for people who I don't even know.
Well, it's about helping people with death, but it's about life.
Yes.
And that's always the case. And
death is the only freaking teacher we pay attention to. Nothing else gets our attention. If this pandemic, if this virus wasn't lethal, do you think we'd be shut down like this? Not a chance. Not a chance. The only wake-up call, the only real teacher, in my opinion, is death. You know, Kafka said the meaning of life is that it ends. And
yes.
It's true.
And it's also something that we all go through.
Yes.
And so many people, especially the most evil, are so scared of it that they want to destroy anyone they can. And I don't understand the invincible people that think they can't die and they don't care about others and don't want to believe what others believe. Can't comprehend they're wounded and not loved.
They're wounded.
Yeah.
They're wounded. Jonathan Safran Foer wrote an amazing book called Here I Am. You would love this book, Bob. It's like he's the modern...
Is it like Philip Waldo? Roth. Is it like Carmen Santiago?
No, it's more like Philip Roth. Okay, it's about a marriage crumbling,
which is another loss we did not talk about, except yes. for mentioning the get.
You can lose your marriage.
Divorce is one of the most painful things I've ever gone yes. through in my life.
Yes,
worse than yes. the death of some of my most intimate deaths.
And not to dismiss the pain of it. And I would venture to say, incredibly liberating for you.
Yes, with a lot of pain.
Correct.
And then the pain heals. And then if you're able to have, in my case, with three children, I'm able to have a friend in my life that we shared and we have a strong understanding of it.
And a second marriage.
Yeah.
With all due respect to the first, a second
and
marriage.
She has her person. So and our children are miraculous.
Because they were loved.
Yeah.
But so Jonathan Safran Foer in his book, Here I Am, which is reminiscent of what Abraham and Moses say in the Bible, Hineni, here I am, what God calls them.
Right.
He says, people... I want to get it exactly right if I can. People behave badly because they're wounded.
Right.
And remembering their wounds makes it easier to forgive. And I think that's true. I try to be extremely non-judgmental, and I deal with a lot of people who do a lot of foolish and hurtful things to other people. Mm-hmm. And rather than being judgmental, I always stop and ask myself, where is that flaw in me?
Right.
I try to start with some empathy. When have I been a narcissist? When have I hurt someone's feelings that I claim to love?
And I know when I've done it. In fact, right? During this time, I have reached out to people and I go, please don't think I'm nuts. This is not an extension of my 60-year midlife crisis, but I have something, an albatross I want to talk to you about. And I've done a couple of emails and they were so lovely to say, no, I've gone through this myself.
Yeah.
And there were things that I've regretted. And to be able to do that is very freeing. It's very freeing.
And you did those things because you were wounded.
Well, one case was I could not do a performance in something because 1 hour before my giant monologue on screen was my mother called me and said, I've decided to go into hospice because my body's riddled with tumors. And my response was, what? Why didn't you talk to me? And I have to go, the doctor's coming in. And that was the last conversation before they said action. And I was just on another planet because...
You were wounded.
It's also what the Jewish mother just does.
Yeah.
You got a big thing today? Let me sabotage that for you. Yeah. And I do want to share this with you too. And one other quick thing to discuss, because I know you probably have many people to go help. Am I correct?
I've got a little time, but yeah.
Same here. Oh, perfect. Perfect. My mother did something when she decided to go into hospice. My father didn't have as easy an out. And your dad, I know it was difficult, but you got to whisper in his ear, which I love that you're able to have conversations and you believe in that. And that's imparted in this book so beautifully, to say memories of things that were wonderful in your life with a person as they're going, whether people think they can hear you or not.
I always assume hearing is the last thing to go. Always.
I think a fart is the very last thing. Sorry, that's my dad. But he had diabetes and they removed 3 toes. He didn't want to live like that. Yeah. And he didn't go out that easily. And he was beautiful. And I had a sister that passed from scleroderma. And I spoke to you about this previously.
Yes.
She did not, in this book, you kept saying how it's one of the most beautiful parts of your life is the actual transition as you're passing. Hers was, and you helped me here, hers was begging me to help her. The day before she passed, she went, help me. I said, I am. And I had to tell her that she had to let go, that her body didn't work anymore because of a disease.
That was a gift.
It's still painful to me.
Yes.
I did it with Rodney Dangerfield in intensive care, and John Lovett says I killed him. But Rodney was in a coma, and I said, Rodney, you got to let the body go. I love you. I don't want you to go. If you can get better, please get better. And he started to squeeze my hand, and his widow said that was kind of the most reaction we've seen. I'm positive he heard me.
He heard you.
And my sister at the end, they had her morphined, which is a gift also. And my mother, however, was having people visit her. She only had ice chips because she didn't want to soil herself and look beautiful. She had a nice suite with a little coffee bar in it at St. John's. And my friends would come visit her. She would put makeup on when John Stamos or Brad was coming, people that she loved. They're going to be here. I said, you're not going to make out with them. You're just going to visit them. You don't have to. And I have photos of her.
Yeah.
Steve, she had a halo around her the whole time. Every picture. There wasn't lighting to be a spotlight. It wasn't a ring light that people use on their podcasts or CNN reporting from wherever they are in their apartment. She literally, have you seen this glow in people as they're getting to this state?
Yes, because first of all, there are many things at a certain point, there are many things worse than dying. There are many times when more is not better. And, you know, when the closest thing I can come to without having died myself and being able to come back and talk about it. But I've been at the bedside of about 1,000 dying people, and that's not rabbinic hyperbole. That's a pretty accurate number. And not one single time has one of them been afraid. Now, I'm talking about people who are actively dying, Bob. I'm talking about hours or a day from death. And the closest thing I can compare it to is when you are just completely, totally exhausted. You are wrung out. You are spent. Like the worst jet lag you have ever had in your life. All you want to do is crawl into bed, and pull the covers up over your head and go to sleep. You're not depressed about going to sleep. You're not anxious about going to sleep. You're not angry about going to sleep. It is the most natural thing in the world. The rabbis, in there are two prayers traditionally said at a Jewish funeral. The first of those two prayers was written by the rabbis, and it calls death menucha nechona in Hebrew. In English, that means perfect rest. Perfect sleep.
That's all people want.
And that's what it is.
And that's what my mother did. The biggest gift she ever gave me and all my friends, all her relatives and friends that visited with her, she would sit there in bed saying, "You're going to be fine."
She was comforting you.
She comforted everyone.
Let me ask you something.
It was literally like having Yoda.
Was she like that during her life also?
Never. She would give you the comfort in ways. She was my mom, so she did. But she also was the one that said, "Don't say that, Bobby. Don't talk like that. Don't use those words." Well, guess what I did?
Let me ask that differently. When the chips were down, when you were getting divorced or whatever.
Yeah, you're correct. You're correct. She was positive. She said, "You're going to get through this," and she would say, "And she's going to be okay," meaning my ex-wife.
Yeah.
And I said, "This is terrible. I don't know what to do." There was one moment where, this is so personal. I walked into their condo the first night that I
ended your marriage. Yeah.
Yeah. And I walked in with a couple suitcases, and I went, "Mom, Dad, I'm home." And my dad was laughing. And my mom was, "Well, you'll sleep here." And they open up the sofa bed, and it's the one my sister had passed away in. And I went, "You know, I'm going to the hotel." So I left, and I kissed them both. But my mother did have, in those hard times, she always was so strong. But I think she had so much trauma herself in her life that that's what made her so controlling and wouldn't let me have freedom to sleep over friends' houses, and fear of everything, fear of sports for me, fear of...
That is a very common dynamic in the children of survivors, you know that.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, when you really were in trouble, she would rescue you. And that didn't change because she was dying. This is a major point in the book that I talk about, which
is that
people die the same way they live. Dying does not give the living or the dying a new personality. It just intensifies who we already are.
It's the resin of...
Yeah, that's right. And sometimes
it's the resin of the beauty of what remains.
There you go. And it all, yeah. And sometimes it's terrible that people die the way they live. And sometimes it's really beautiful. And in your mom's case, really beautiful. And she raised a good boy, Bobby.
She called me Bobby. Holy heck. Wake up, Bobby. It was like a ghost. Well, that's as good a time as any. The only thing I wanted to wind this up, the only thing I wanted to mention also that people will love is all of your references to music, because as well as comedy, it's as significant how much music has healed shared with
people. It's a big part of my life. Yeah.
And it's beautiful. It's beautiful. Yeah. All of the recollections. I mean, there's literal lyrics from so many songs here. I won't go into it because it'd be a whole other time we don't have.
Yeah.
Well, we'll continue it on the 28th when we do our talk at the Stryker Center. And Steve, I can't thank you enough.
Thank you. You're a beautiful friend, and I love you. And
I love you too. And I'm not afraid to say it.
Nor am I. And I'm very grateful to you for all the attention you're bringing to the book, because I hope it really helps people. And I deeply appreciate it. We can't get anywhere without our friends.
We can't. And the book is truly quite a remarkable work. My wife read some passages to her dad, and they're a beautiful Italian Christian family. And universal's universal.
That's right.
And that's what's so special about
this
book.
Right.
And I look forward to our next talk.
So do I. God bless. Thank you, Bob.
God bless. Be well. I really enjoyed talking with him. He is a genuinely wonderful man. The amazing thing when you do one of these Zoom interviews is you can see all the books on his shelf, so I know which ones to borrow when I go over there. This is a lovely book, The Beauty of What Remains. I recommend it highly to everybody. And then listen to us, watch us in our Zoom conversation on January 28th, the Stryker Center in New York and Temple Emmanuel. And you can just get to StrykerCenter.com, I think, and you'll find it, S-T-R-E-I-K-E-R. And it's January 28th. And we'll be discussing some of the things we talk about on this podcast, and we'll also be discussing a lot of other things because I'll get into more specifics of passages from the book. And it's real special, so get it for somebody that you care about or get it for yourself to help you through possibly a difficult time because so many of us are going through one right now. And I'm sending you my best, everybody. Rate, review, subscribe, follow, subscribe and listen. You got to subscribe, buy all the products. I don't know. Whatever. Do all those things. And I'm wishing you well. I'm wishing you good health. And I keep saying onward and upward, like I'm Jimmy Neutron, but I don't think he said those words exactly, but he did say something like that. But up, up, and away. No, onward and upward throughout the rest of this year. And I hope your lives improve. And there's lots of peace and love for you and all those you care about. See, this is what he did to me. This is what talking to Steve Leader did to me. Don't do religion and politics. I guess I'll have a politician on next week. Nope. No thanks. Next week's just going to be pure comedy. Anyway, sending you guys lots of love. Bye.